Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. The classic play set in South Africa during the apartheid era, Sizwe Bonzi is Dead, is the latest production of the Crossroads Theatre Company in New Brunswick. I'll chat with the stars of the show, Atandwa Kani and Kelsey Watson.
To have the opportunity to revive it today at the Crossroads Theatre, which is sort of the pioneering theatre when it comes to black stories, it really is such an honour, and it just seems like something that was destined to be.
And WBGO's John Kalish has the story of New York's Oscar Cohen, one of the activists opposing public school funding to religious schools.
The East Ramapo School District includes the ultra-Orthodox Jewish towns of Muncie and New Square. These tight-knit communities vote as a block, usually at the direction of the Rebbe or Chief Rabbi.
All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. Crossroads Theatre's production of the classic play Sizwe Bonzi is Dead runs from May 19th through June 14th in New Brunswick. The play is directed by Ricardo Khan in collaboration with Tony Award winner John Connie, Black Panther and Mufasa, The Lion King, and many other shows. John Connie is the last remaining member of the writing team. We lost Winston Neshona in 2018, and we lost Ethel Fugard just last year. Sizwe Bonzi is Dead is a powerful, funny, and deeply moving story about identity, survival, and the extraordinary ingenuity of ordinary people navigating an unjust system. Set during South Africa's apartheid era, the play follows a man faced with an impossible choice: disappear under the weight of an oppressive system or reinvent himself in order to survive. What unfolds is a story filled with wit, humanity, and resilience, revealing the profound ways that Black people have always found dignity, humor, and hope, even in the harshest circumstances. Joining us today are the stars of the play, Atandwa Kani and Kelsey Watson. Gentlemen, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It was back in 1975. Atandwa, your father, John Kani, and Winston Neshona made history when they won the Tony Awards for their performances in the Broadway production of Sizwe Bonzi is Dead, bringing international attention to the realities of apartheid through the power of storytelling. And now, it's a landmark in global theater. Atandwa, I know this Crossroads Theater production marking the 50th anniversary of your father's Tony Award has to be very special for you.
Absolutely, absolutely. This production, when it was done in its time, sort of exposed the injustices of such a horrible system. And to be celebrated in that manner, the Tony Awards, and to return home and put in solitary confinement, sort of was the confusing part. You know what I'm saying? So to have the opportunity to revive it again today at the Crossroads Theatre, which is sort of the pioneering theatre when it comes to Black stories and the diasporic Black storytelling. It's such an honour. It really is such an honour. And it just seems like something that was destined to be.
I know Ricardo couldn't wait to direct this play because he talked about it with me quite a long time ago when it was first put on the books. How has it been working with Ricardo?
I've worked with Ricardo before when we did Fences in South Africa, August Wilson's play. And he's such an amazing, amazing director. He's an actor's director. He understands exactly what he's requesting of the artist. And we're having a great time in there.
Yeah. No, we get to explore. We get to have fun. Ricardo kind of lets us, you know, We kind of have our own intuitions about our character's journey when storytelling, but Ricardo really has helped us like fine-tune moments in there, and we're continuing to find more of these moments in the play. It's very poignant to not only us, but we think to the audience members when they see the final production when we go up on May 19th.
Kelsey, you have roots in New York City, the Academy, the American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Oh, wow, yeah.
In 2001. When did you first learn about Sizwe Bonzi is Dead?
I'll be honest with you, this year when I was auditioning for the piece, and then once we decided to move on and actually accept the offer and for me to accept the role, I did some, you know, you have the internet now these days, so now you can do deep diving on like the author, Dr. John Kani as well, and Winston, and also the impact and what they went through to just put the play up. And you know it, I knew of Master Harold and the Boys. This is one of these ones that were, you know, it hasn't been mentioned in a while. And I'm glad that it's making its revision. So, and I'm glad that you know, it was available to somebody like me. So, usually at this time, it was like at the audition process is when I knew about the play.
On one that we know that people recognize you and your dad from Black Panther because it was such an amazing film that reached all across the globe. The people just responded to that.
Right.
But well before that, you guys have been doing amazing work together. What does dad mean to you?
Dad. So we have a very strange relationship, me and Dr. Carney. When it's at work, it's Dr. Carney. When it's at home, because there's a difference when he's at home. At home, he's the man that screams at me for not having done my bed or not helping my mother in the kitchen or the dogs haven't been fed. So I know that man at home. I often meet people in the theater when they're speaking of Dr. Carney in this amazing, he's such a lovely man. And I looked at them when I was young. I'm like, which man are you talking about? I know this totalitarian dictator at home. I don't know. But honestly, he's as a man for me, he raised me and he brought me up and he's exposed me to so many things that have progressed in my life and personally and artistically. He's a hero to me. He really is. He's a hero to many people in across the world, but for me particularly, he is my actual hero. He's a man that has taught me so much about how to be a man, about respect and responsibility, about rising to the occasion, about leading other people, learning how to follow before you can lead. So I am exposed to the entirety of Dr. John Carney, not just the artist, but the man behind the artist and the father and the husband and the leader. So he means the world to me, basically, is my answer.
This play has three main characters: Styles, Sizwe Bonzi, or Robert in this, and then Buntu. Tell us a little bit for those who haven't seen the play. Let's start with you, Atanwa. Tell us about your character and going through this now. What have you learned about your character?
Well, so the play opens and we meet Styles. And Styles is a photographer, but before that, he used to work at Ford Motor Company assembling engines. And what I've learned about Styles is that he's always looking for a brighter moment. Because when you're in apartheid in the 70s, it all seems like doom and gloom and it's dim. And Styles is always looking for that flash moment of just peace or happiness or laughter. So he's that kind of guy. He's never beaten. He's never defeated. Becoming a photographer, he wants to preserve memories and moments in Black people's lives. You know, in those photographic studios where you have a telephone the cord is not attached to anything. It's about the dream of having. He's a big dreamer, and he captures the moments of dreaming. And then Buntu is the everyday man. He lives for now. He's a street smart person who knows the ins and outs of this apartheid law, about this passbook, the dorm book, the reference book. So he's a man that knows how to navigate the world for now. So the differences between those two is it's so vast. But I enjoy playing them both because you have a bit of this, a bit of hope and light and funny, and then you have a man who is just so practical and pragmatic and just wants to solve the issue. And you learn as a human being how to navigate your own life really through your characters. Perhaps maybe you live vicariously through your characters. When you have certain issues in your life, you can be practical about it, or you can, you know, make light of it or whatever. So they're two very different characters. And this is the beauty of this play, the way that it's written. Even Robert and Sizwe are two different people played by the same character. So.
It's well played.
You mentioned that you just learned about this play, Kelsey. So as you play, Sizwe and Robert, I'm sure you checked out how it was done in the past, but what did you try to bring to this character?
I just think a bit of heart and humanity, and also showing, you know, a man who I think just like anybody in this world, especially the things that are going on right now, somebody who wants to provide for his family and to seek opportunity where there is that opportunity to provide for them. So in a way you could be like, since this is the 70s and Port Elizabeth, where he's trying to find a work at, is this like goal and dream of providing for his family. You could say it parallels to when people come to this country, in search of the American dream, as an immigrant or a foreigner from like a distant land. And even though the land technically is all theirs, and we could say that about like a parallel of many things and many issues today. I just think what I'm trying to bring is a sense of humanity, and a man who is very practical, but he also has a very determined spirit of like trying to figure out, okay, this seems impossible. What can we do to make it possible? So he doesn't really take no for an answer until a certain point, but he's willing to try. And I think that's the great thing about Seizeway, and Robert is the result of Seizeway's, wanting to try and his willingness to try.
I think what's beautiful about the play is the wit and humor that's also involved. Talk a little bit about that, Kelsey.
I just watch a Atandwa, really be entertaining for like the first half of the show. I kind of feel like I'd bring the whole thing down when I come on stage. But no, we have some really great moments. There is a moment where we in the futility of the system that we live in this apartheid, in the story, we go have libations at a very good place. And there is a very good moment, like when we leave Sky's place, that we have like these very good hearty moments. And I've found myself actually laughing at Atandwa and just, how we're reacting to each other. So I like that there is a bit of levity in the play. It's needed, just to also show like in all this tragedy, you have to find humor. Thank goodness for all three, for Winston and John and Arthel, for like finding that. Like you could really downtrodden this. And this could just be a bang over your head message, and this is bad and this is terrible. But you also have to know that even in the light of all of this, wrongdoing that apartheid is, and this, how they try to bring, the black man down, there's always art found in it. There's always humor found in our struggle. And that's what these guys find in some light moments. But especially this guy in the first 30 minutes, like he'll tell you all about it. So I'll defer to you, partner. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly like you say. No matter how dark your situation is, no matter how gloomy it is, we are human beings and we enjoy love, we enjoy lightness, we love to laugh. So they're not going to take all of that away from us, especially in such an unjust system where it's man's inhumanity against man. They may take everything away from us, but not our spirits, not our joy, not our humor, not our lightness. This theme of the smile in the play, right? Where they want to see you smile for the photograph. So they think that you're happy, and all that they're doing to you is not enough. So it really aggravates them that they cannot destroy the black human spirit. It is impossible. And also, it's also a technique theatrically, especially in South Africa, also around the world, where you lull the audience into a safe zone of security, and it's nice and it's warm and it's jokey, and then you come in with the truth because now they're open and receptive. So if we preach at them, it's highly likely to close off because it is such a poignant, deep, heavy message, talking about the lives of these people. And at the forefront, it's not apartheid. You know what I'm saying? This is the beauty of the Khani, Njona, and Vuyo God writing. We don't focus on apartheid. We focus on a human being that is in the midst of this world, that is going through the trials and tribulations and these unbreakable, unstoppable, nonsensical rules of apartheid, and how that affects that man. So it's a story of this man, Sizwe Banzi, really, who happens to live in apartheid. And because he's a human being and he's a black man, there are moments of lightness and laughter. We can laugh at each other, because all we've done is cry thus far. So when we're done crying, can we have a little bit of joy? Just a little bit.
Being from South Africa, apartheid is very real for you, throughout your life. But sometimes when we think about it was just 50 years ago that this was, that's not that long ago, you know, and it boggles the mind sometimes for, you know, those of us who weren't there.
Right.
Tell us about that.
So I was born in 1984, and South Africa got its independence in 1994. So for the first 10 years of my life, I witnessed many atrocities. I witnessed situations that should never have been, people living in conditions that should have been fixed a long time ago. And then during the transition phase into this democratic era, you witness the repercussions of this unjust system upon people who have voted finally, but haven't gotten what they voted for. So it's all around you when you're in South Africa. It's, even in today's times, there are certain situations and locations where, you know, democracy and freedom hasn't reached them yet. So it's something that will scar every South African for as long as possible, which also highlights the bravery of these men to do a play like this, which is exposing this unjust system. And having done it here in the United States on Broadway, that was, you know, that must have been the scariest thing. So, and as they write, because they wrote, it's almost autobiographic. The people they speak about in the play, are people in their lives. So I speak so the character of Muntu speaks about his father and the diamond black suit and the hat. And that was my grandfather. And we speak about Jacob going to a funeral. That was my great grandfather. So for me personally, there's this immediate link that just touches me emotionally in a way that I can't control or explain. But it is such an honor and a pleasure to have this opportunity to bring this to life again, especially at the crossroads with Rick Hahn and Kelsey. It's just, I mean, if we could do this forever, exposing the unjust systems around the world. And it's weird at Crossroads, what happened in South Africa in the 70s with the immigration laws, with this documentation that we almost have to have, that robbing people of their own citizenship and exporting them and deporting them somewhere. That horrible situation, it seems to be what's happening now in the United States. So it's reminiscent of that. It seems like deja vu for me living in the United States now, that ICE is doing what they're doing. And it's such, just an unjust, unfair system. So sometimes I get a little PTSD when I'm walking down the streets of the United States. That's a very scary situation to be in.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you played Nelson Mandela as well.
I did indeed.
And what was that experience like for you?
That was also, I mean, the kind of plays that I do, the kind of, you know, the works that I do are, because I'm black, they're very heavily black represented, exposing injustices, speaking truth to power. I'd like to, you know, as artists, we put a mirror to society so that they can recognize themselves in their uglinesses and their beauties. So playing characters, I mean, I was on set with Idris Elba and Naomi Harris, so that was a treat in itself. But having an opportunity to play, because we never play our own heroes, you know, this is an African sort of dilemma. It's always other people playing our heroes, the Idi Amins and Nelson Mandela, Steve Biko's. So it was an opportunity to, you know, claim my stake in that kind of way. And it was just a beautiful experience. And everyone was so respectful and had so much love for the great man.
Kelsey, I'm curious, when you have a two-person show, three characters, but a two-person show like this, knowing the history that his family has gone through and having the opportunity to share the stage with him and learn about his dad and everything, has to be an enlightening experience that has led to a friendship that you probably couldn't imagine.
So far, absolutely. I mean, we have talked to Dr. John Connie on occasion via Zoom when he was in LA doing Master Hild and the Boys. So we got even more insight on like the story behind this play and some of the meanings of some of the things in it, and his personal, you know, struggles when he was performing it, you know, before it went to Broadway. Like when he was just like doing guerrilla theater and like sneaking from theater to theater with very little equipment and everything else, because as soon as they got done performing, they had to get out of there because the police, you know, would could arrest them for making, making a play like this. The beauty about a two-man show is it is a partnership of trust and of skill, and it's just so it's refreshing when you have somebody who is not only very close to the source material, has done it before, but also allows you to put your interpretation of like what you think of the character, for you, how it fits you as in your personality. I'm never going to do it like Winston. He's never going to do it like his father. We're just going to do it the way that we see it, in our eyes now as black men, who are around the world, as any black man around the world, because let's face it, that we're kind of persecuted everywhere and judged everywhere. If you really want to get to it, like go to soccer games with like a soccer player that makes like 15, 20 million, bajillion dollars, and they'll still get called, slurs and names, and they'll have bananas thrown at them, and that is around the world, and so, and now we're facing, we've always faced that dilemma here in America. Now it's just more out in the front because the powers that be have allowed it, encourage it. And so it's made more people embrace their hatred and embrace their ignorance and their prejudices. So we always have to shine a mirror on that society. And so when you do something like this that's powerful, and it's gone to places that I don't think that either one of us thought it could go. And as far as our performances, and so every day we're just kind of egging each other on. Like to us, we're just doing the work. So it really, and it's that trust of having a partner like Atanwa, that makes that possible.
Tonwa, I know this is an overused question, but I'm going to ask it to you anyway. As people were leaving the theater, what do you want them to be thinking about?
I want them to be thinking about their own humanity. I want them to be thinking about the history of the place that they come from, how they can contribute to making it a little bit better. I want them to focus on how human we all are at the end of the day. Just to realize that, because we live in blanket statements sometimes. You're an American, or you're South African, or this is apartheid. Underneath all that is the individual, and that individual has a mother, has a father, has siblings, has friends, has hobbies, has likes, has been in love, is loved by someone, is a fully formed human being. So to leave the theater knowing that everybody has their struggle, everybody has their own path in life, has their own life. So to not discriminate, to not judge the book by the cover, to help out, and not to simply pull out a phone and record these days, but to actually be an active participant in society and its progression as well. That's what I want them. And to be exposed to this story about this man living in South Africa who's been denied the basic educational rights to read, to understand the system, and is now in this dilemma, but meets a friend that helps him somehow through it. We spend so much time at odds with each other, so much time just being polarized as a society. You're either this or you're that, as opposed to being humans, at all of us having the same wants and needs, basically.
Powerful statements. I want to thank our guests today, Atanwa Kani and Kelsey Watson, for joining us on the WBGO Journal. Crossroads Theater Company's production of Sizwe Banzi Is Dead runs from May 19th through June 14th in New Brunswick. The town of Ramapo, New York, lies just across the New Jersey border. For the last 20 years, a bitter conflict over educational spending has played out between the area's ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities and residents who send their children to public schools. One of the activists opposing public school funds going to religious schools is a man named Oscar Cohen. WBGO's John Kalish has the story.
Oscar Cohen grew up in the Bronx. He and his brother lived in a one-bedroom apartment for 20 years with their deaf parents. In the 1960s, he was able to go to graduate school tuition-free, thanks to a federal program that sought to encourage careers in special education.
Okay, 1, 2, 3.
I met him 30 years ago when I visited the Lexington School for the Deaf in Queens, where he served as superintendent.
I was attracted to Lexington because my father is a graduate of the Lexington School for the Deaf. Many of the people who work in this field are relatives of people who are deaf themselves. And the one thing that makes Lexington and other schools for the deaf unique is that students have communication access. They are being taught by teachers who can communicate directly with them, surrounded by therapists, counselors, support staff who can communicate directly with them. So the feeling of community is very great.
One of the school's benefactors was a childhood friend of Cohen's, the fashion designer Ralph Lauren.
He had been to the school. I would invite him to the school. He would meet the kids. And he also did a very wonderful thing by helping to renovate our auditorium to make it into a special place for deaf children who could act and perform.
Cohen retired from the Lexington School for the Deaf in 2000, but he decided to continue working. He started and then ran the Ralph Lauren Corporate Foundation, which is dedicated to cancer care. Since leaving the foundation, he's been politically active in the NAACP, which has been battling the burgeoning ultra-Orthodox Jewish community over the way it's been running the public schools in East Ramapo, New York. The bitter clash was the subject of an episode of This American Life in 2014. Reporter Ben Calhoun describes a shrinking high school yearbook to illustrate the cutbacks imposed by the ultra-Orthodox school majority in the years after 2008.
You can actually see the yearbooks get thinner and thinner and thinner. The business department, that was several pages, all eliminated. There were other departments cut by 80%. Full pages of honor societies, sports, JROTC, AP classes, clubs, dance, home ec, administrative staff. Here's a partial list from the last 5 years. All deans, all social workers eliminated. All assistant principals at the elementary school level, music instruction for elementary school kids, funding for field trip buses, all eliminated.
The East Ramapo School District includes the ultra-Orthodox Jewish towns of Muncie and New Square. These tight-knit communities vote as a block, usually at the direction of the Rebbe or chief rabbi. The observant Jews who live there all send their children to private religious schools. In control of the school district, they've spent substantial percentages of the educational budget on busing and special education for Orthodox Jewish children. Here's Oscar Cohen.
What you hear from the ultra-Orthodox community is, we vote, we pay taxes, we should be able to do that. And I think that's an issue with democracy. In order for a budget to pass, you need a referendum. And they have so many more people voting than the public school parents do. We have the highest rate of budget rejections in New York State.
The same scenario has played out in Lakewood, New Jersey, where a school district controlled by ultra-Orthodox Jews has bankrupted the public education system with a similar dynamic, insufficient taxes, along with huge expenditures on busing and special education. Cohen points out that the East Ramapo School District's decision to provide universal busing, no matter how far students live from their school, ends up detracting from the money that's actually spent on education.
You're picking up kids that are a block away or two blocks away, but the state's not giving you any extra money for that universal busing. That money would otherwise go for education. So there's less money going for the public school children. And in this community, the public school children are 95% children of color.
Oscar Cohen says there's been a dramatic deterioration of public education in the East Ramapo School District. He says it was once among the highest rated public school districts in New York State, but now East Ramapo is the lowest rated district in Rockland County.
A lot of people are moving out. People who have children in the district, if they have the means, I'm talking about people of color now, are moving away, because the education they're getting is inferior. And that's clear. We have all the data that show that.
Cohen says the data includes graduation and dropout rates, as well as reading, math, and science test scores. In 2021, the NAACP and its allies prevailed in a federal lawsuit against the East Ramapo School District. As a result, there are now three public school parents on the school board, but the ultra-Orthodox Jewish members still have a supermajority. Oscar Cohen is still active in the NAACP, still involved in its efforts to improve public education. For the WBGO Journal, I'm John Kalish.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO and WBGO.org.